seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 10-0683, consolidated for argument with 10-0714, AHF Arbors versus Walker County Appraisal District.
Court, Mr. Sheehan will present arguments for the petitioners. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This appeal concerns the tax-exempt status of a 420 low to moderate income apartment complex located in Walker County, Texas. Arbors, the record title holder to the property, applied for a Texas Tax Code Section 11.182 tax exemption for the tax years 2003 and beyond. The Walker County Appraisal District denied Arbor's application for tax exemption, and that denial was ultimately appealed to this court. Now, Arbor's contends that it's entitled to the tax exemption it seeks on two distinct grounds. The first is that Arbor's contends that the property is tax exempt because it is equitably owned by Arbor's parent company, Atlantic Housing Foundation. And Atlantic Housing Foundation is a certified 501c3 organization, and it's also a registered and certified community housing development organization with this state.
Is it still in bankruptcy?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is it still in bankruptcy?
I don't believe it is in bankruptcy, Your Honor.
It has been, right?
No? I don't believe those are the facts in our record, Your Honor. I may be mistaken, but I do not believe it's currently in bankruptcy.
This is American Housing Foundation.
Atlantic Housing Foundation, Your Honor. If I said American Housing Foundation, I meant to say Atlantic. Housing Foundation.
And so the case that we have abated here is still waiting some completion of that bankruptcy.
That's right, Your Honor. I believe that the court is referring to the TRQ case. And that case is on very similar facts to the instant case here because it dealt squarely with the equitable ownership issue. And if you recall, that case came from the First Court of Appeals. And the First Court of Appeals held that because the equitable owner was a certified tax-exempt entity and could compel legal title to the property held by the record owner, that the property was, in fact, tax-exempt. That was the holding of the First Court of Appeals, and that was the issue that was presented to the court. However, I think it's important to note that our case is even better facts, I believe, for the court to rule on the equitable ownership position here because TRQ involved a somewhat complex ownership structure. In that case, the property, the record owner, was a limited partnership. Then there was an LLC that owned the limited partnership, and then there was the ultimate charitable parent who owned the LLC, who owned the limited partnership. Here, we don't have that multi-tiered structure. It's a simple two-tiered structure with a specific purpose entity, which is Arbors LLC, who is the record title holder to the property, and its sole member, its entire owner, is Atlantic Housing Foundation, who reserves the right to dissolve Arbors at any time with a stroke of a pen and take title to all of Arbors' assets. And so while we believe that if the court had the opportunity to hear the TRQ case, we would offer that we would hope the court would rule that equitable ownership is accepted. That's an accepted definition under the statute. We think that in our case, the relationship between the two entities is even more clear and direct because there's not an intermediary entity.
Let's make sure you get your two basic reasons for the property's exemption. You've already expressed one.
Thank you, Justice. The second prong is the second reason why we believe that the tax exemption should be afforded to Arbors is because we contend that Arbors independent satisfies the statute independent of Atlantic, in that we presented at the trial court summary judgment evidence sufficient for the court to determine that even aside from Atlantic, Arbors complied with the terms of the statute.
Now, is it making a profit?
Your Honor, no, it is not. The articles of incorporation specifically state that it is a not-for-profit entity and that all of the profits from Arbors go to Atlantic. And Atlantic, as a charitable tax as a 501c3, has to comply with those various regulations and distribute its profits, and actually doesn't retain profits, pays salaries, reasonable salaries, and things of that nature. So no, the answer to your question is no, it does not. And so that is an important distinction, because that is why this case is also separate from the 11182E cases, such as the Cameron Village case and some of the in the Brazos County case, is that this in no way was owned by a for-profit limited partnership. It was owned by two nonprofits.
I think there's some dispute or question about whether an audit was done and properly delivered to the authority. You say you can independently support this contention. Was that all complied with?
Yes, Your Honor, that is part of Walker County's basis. They're part of their argument in this court. Specifically, what they're saying is that the Court of Appeals held that there was no evidence of delivery of an audit to the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. Now, that is one prong of the statute. The statute is multi-prong, and that section 11.182G requires three things. It requires, first, that an audit be created. And the record's clear that an audit was created in this case for the property. It requires that an audit be delivered to the chief appraiser for Walker County. It's beyond dispute that that happened as well. Where the dispute lies and where the Court of Appeals hung its opinion is that there is no, and according to the Court of Appeals, under a no evidence review, it did not believe that there was sufficient evidence to overcome a no evidence standard of delivery of that audit to the TDHCA. The TDHCA is not a party to this case, Your Honor. I think the issue that we wanted to bring before the court today, I think it is of significant importance to the state, and that is the equitable ownership issue. And that is because the term own is not defined in the statute.
Would your view somehow allow abuses of the tax exemption?
Your Honor.
And what safeguards are there to prevent that from happening?
Your Honor, I do not think it would. Allowing the term, allowing the definition of own to include both record title holders and equitable title holders, I mean, as initial matters, a threshold matter, I think that the statute contemplates that own can mean both of those things. As this court has held in the past, an own is subject to various meanings.
What about if a subsidiary is blatantly doing something that's non-charitable?
And that is, Your Honor, that is a good point. That is why the statute has multiple prongs. It has requirements that it needs to meet. You have to certify when you supply your tax application that you're complying with the terms of the statute.
Well, for example, could a CHDO own a for-profit company?
No, Your Honor.
That's impermissible?
No.
Okay, so there's no risk of a for-profit company qualifying for the exemption based on the nonprofit status of a parent?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but what you're going to see is that that situation can arise, not your exact situation, but where you see a mix of a nonprofit and for-profit entities can arise under that subsection E of the statute, that 11.182E. Here, we don't have that situation because we have a company that does not accrue profits, that's a record title holder, and then the certified nonprofit who is the owner. But that is a valid concern, and that is what the legislator attempted to curtail by the 2001 amendments by adding Section E. It allowed allowed for-profit limited partnerships, because limited partnerships have to be for-profit under the Partnership Act, to basically continue to be involved with with Section 11.182 and continue to invest in the provision of affordable housing. But it tightened the statute down a little bit. It said in order for that to happen, if a limited partnership is going to be involved in this situation, the CHDO has to own 100% of the general partner of the entity that is the record title holder of the property. And that's because at core what we're worried about here, Your Honor, is that the property is managed and ran in accordance with the purposes of the statute, and that a certain amount of the tax exemption is reinvested into the community. And when you have, like there are some other cases floating around out there in the Court of Appeals where the CHGO will own 1/1,000th of a percent of the general partner, I think there's a concern that the for-profit entities may put may have more control over the property than the true CHGO, who's answerable to the TDHCA, who may be answerable to the federal government or 501c3.
How does a CHGO establish that it's organized as a CHGO versus merely indicating an intent to operate as such?
Well, Your Honor, the statute's not entirely clear on that point. It does speak in terms of must be organized as a CHDO. And so we would submit that that language can appear in the Articles of Incorporation, the company's regulations. Now here, in order to be certified as a CHDO, you need to apply to Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs, just like Atlantic did in this case and received a certification establishing it as a CHDO. So the statute is not entirely clear on that point, but I think at core, again, it brings us back to how are these funds being used? Is the property truly offering to rent and renting to low and moderate income people? Because what the state wants to avoid is having to assume this task itself. This is a function that investors or charitable organizations provide to low and moderate income Texans. And if, you know, I would submit that if the court narrowly constricts this statute to disallow this tiered ownership that's going on all across the state right now, it risks removing that exemption, which in our case is multi-million dollars, from these specific perp entities and their parent companies. And the result is that some of these properties may go into foreclosure. There are going to be significant operational concerns. And what can end up happening is these properties are foreclosed, then that burden can fall back to the state. Alternatively, if there's no incentive to realize if that tax credit is not available anymore to that tiered structured entity, it doesn't seem to me that they have any choice but to raise the rates to make up for that loss in profit margin, bringing them outside the scope of that low to moderate income housing window.
Aren't we supposed to construe tax exemptions narrowly?
Yes, Your Honor, that is a fundamental tenet of tax law. However, and this is the fallacy in Walker County's argument, it's that is step one. That's the spectacle through which the court views the tax exemption, and that's the lens through which it views legislative intent. So the inquiry does not stop at strict construction, and that's the issue that I saw in the Brazos County opinion, that's the issue that I saw in the Cameron Village opinion, is that those courts assume that own is restricted to legal title holder. But that's not necessarily the case, and in fact, it's not the case. The court needs to go beyond that and look at what the legislative purpose is. And the legislative purpose, the sole legislative purpose of 11.182 is to provide and further the availability of affordable housing. That does not happen if it's restricted to legal title holders because it's undercutting these charitable organizations' ability to go out and purchase property, to invest in property.
How would you fare under 11.1825?
It's a different statute, Your Honor. Obviously, it is a much more complex and rigorous statute. Only about half of the tax exemption would be available, which I would submit would have the same effect, which would be either a raise in rents, potential risk for foreclosure. And I do think that there is a concern, and why I think this case is so important, is that own is not defined under 11.1825 either. And so
under C, it kind of looks like more direct ownership than equitable ownership, because it talks in terms of a parent.
I agree with you, Your Honor, and I think not only does 11.1825 seem to allow for tiered ownership, there is no doubt that 11.182 also does by way of E, by allowing the limited partnership structure to come into play. And that's a concern. What I'm concerned about and what the property owners are concerned about is that not only will, if a narrow construction is accepted here, not just a narrow construction, but only the right of a legal title holder to possess the property. If that's how the court restricts the statute here, I think that the appraisal districts across the state are going to affect essentially a land grab, and they're going to attack any application going forward where there is a tiered ownership structure, essentially. I think it gives rise to multiple problems.
What's the purpose for delivering the audit to the housing department?
Well, Your Honor, Walker, I think we need to look at it in the overall framework of the importance of the audit. All right. Walker County, the appraisal district, is the sole entity who's responsible for determining whether or not the property owner gets the exemption. Now, can the TDHCA have some input? Sure, but Walker County makes that decision on the application. So essentially what's happening here is Walker County is asserting another entity's position. Now, the TDHCA has multiple responsibilities, one of which is a reporting requirement. It'll take these audits and report to the government to the governor to advise them how these tax credits are being used, essentially. It also can accept people as being CHOTOs, community housing development organizations. And it's also on some level responsible for distributing federal funds under the National Affordable Housing Act. Now, none of that applies to this case because Atlantic and Arbors were not seeking to gain the benefit of federal funds. They were just seeking to get the tax credits that they applied for at the time, and at the time the statute was in place, to promote the availability of affordable housing. That's what they were seeking.
Yes, Counselor. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sheehan, the court will now hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Evans will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Evans of Hargrove and Evans for the Walker County Appraisal District. The Court of Appeals in this case, the 10th Court, did not address at all, in its opinion, the issue of tiered ownership or whether whatever status Atlantic has imputes to somebody else. The only thing the 10th Court addressed was whether an audit was furnished to the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs. And that section, that requirement is found in section 11.182G of the Texas Tax Code. And there are three or four different requirements. One is that an audit must be furnished. And that section says to receive an exemption, an audit must be prepared, which details the sources and uses of funds. Furthermore, the audit must be delivered to the chief appraiser and must be delivered to the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs.
The two entities communicate about the contents of the audit, or what is, I guess, to echo the same question, what is the underlying purpose of
They don't have to communicate. The bill analysis in 2001, which is the year that section, subsection G, was enacted, says this about the enactment of G, that there were concerns that the owners of CHDOs were not taking the money they saved in the tax exemption and using that money to fulfill the purposes required in another section, which is to make expenditures on social, educational, and other programs for the benefit of the members. The legislature's concern was this isn't happening, so we're going to have to enact audit requirements. And so I think that while there's no requirement to communicate between the two entities, TDLR's participation in the audit process is critical. Now, while a chief appraiser is responsible for...
Well, how is it critical to the determination of tax-exempt status?
Because
that's done at the chief appraiser's office, correct?
The chief appraiser absolutely is the final arbiter at that level. But TDHCA has staff. It has trained staff. It has resources. It has accounting personnel who can look at these audits and read what the auditor says about where the income sources come from and where the income sources go. Chief appraisers generally are not CPAs.
They're going to call you? Has that ever happened where they call you and say, wait, stop the presses, don't grant an exemption because we've noticed an irregularity?
Where TDHCA calls?
Uh-huh.
I've never experienced that. I can't speak for every appraisal district in the state, though. It might have happened.
Okay.
But I do think that there's a public policy reason for that, and I don't think the legislature would have included TDHCA if there wasn't a legitimate reason for that. And the legitimate reason for imposing that requirement is to make sure that, these entities, these apartment projects, are spending their tax savings the way they're required to under 11-182. And in this case, for example, Arbors at Huntsville 1 and 2 are really upscale apartments in, Huntsville. They were built for Sam Houston State University students. There's no requirement in 11-182 that rents be low or that rents be at a certain level, unlike Section 11.1825, Justice Heck brought up. That section absolutely requires limitations on rent. There's no limitation in 11-182. Hence, the requirement for the TDHCA audit. You know, it's important. The legislature said it needs to be in there, and it's in there now.
Noticeably, though, in G, it does not repeat to receive an exemption with requirements of the next two sentences.
That's right. To receive the exemption is the in the first words in that paragraph. It's not in every sentence in that section.
But you can see, if you were thinking about it, maybe if you don't prepare an audit at all, you don't get the exemption. But if you prepare it and it's not detailed enough, or it doesn't leaves out a source, or it leaves out a use or something, that doesn't cost you the exemption. That just has to do with a deficient audit.
The requirement just says set out the sources and uses of funds, and then, of course, by the CPA, it's prepared by the CPA. The you know, requirements in there to furnish that to TDHCA, and I'd respectfully submit that it would be parsing of the terms to require that every sentence in that section say to receive an audit, you deliver it to the chief appraiser, to receive an audit, you deliver it to TDHCA. I think it's in there. That section is one solid piece there, and I don't think you need to have it in there. I think you probably infer that that's what it means. There's another case that we cited in our brief. It's Texas VOA Elderly Housing versus Montgomery County Appraisal District that talks about missing an element of another section. It's 1118. Which is the charitable organizations section. In that case, VOA Elderly Housing had a dissolution clause that was incorrect. And the Court of Appeals held that the dissolution clause, because it was incorrect, meant that the exemption failed. The upshot is that the owner missed one element of Section 1118. Therefore, that exemption failed. And I don't think that the language in it might have. I'll have to go back and read it. But 11-18 is actually longer than 11-182. And it has all these elements. It missed an element, and they were out. So
oddly, there's no deadline in the statute. So when does it have to be delivered?
It would have to be within, well, it's an annual requirement.
Right.
So, you know, I think there is a deadline. I think it might be in 11.1826. I'm not positive about that. I believe that there is a deadline there. But, you know, Justice Heck, you'd mentioned deadlines, and that brings me to another argument here. Arbors is casting this requirement as being penal in nature, or being punitive, or that the actions by the Court of Appeals works a forfeiture of an exemption that it's entitled to. I want to point out to the court, remind the court, that this is not a forfeiture issue. This is simply a judgment on a no evidence motion for summary judgment, in which the trial court said there's no evidence to meet the exemption. If this case had been tried on the merits instead of pursuant to a no evidence summary judgment, we would have made the same assertion that Arbors is required to satisfy every element of Section 11.182 and because it failed to do this at least one, and we contend there are several other things that Arbor's failed to do, but because it failed to deliver the audit, the exemption fails. And if you go back to the Texas VOA case, you can see that the elements all have to be met. In 11-182, it doesn't say do this, 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 or this. It says do all of these things. And there are about 20 requirements. And, you know, at the end it says and. So every requirement is required to be met. Now, regarding the strict construction issue, you are right that these cases are strictly construed. And in the Cameron Village case, the opinion from that court, the fourth court, is that the term owner has to be strictly construed because this is an exemption case and we're talking about ownership in the exemption context. So since owner is strictly construed, we're looking at the plain language here. Now, I want to point this out, and I may have to brief this later for the court, if the court lets me do this, but this is a limited liability corporation. Actually, there are two limited liability corporations, Arbor's 1 and Arbor's 2. The member of Arbor's 1 and 2 is Atlantic Housing Foundation. Business Organizations Code Section 101.106 states that the member of an LLC does not own the property of the LLC. So while the LLC may be the fee simple owner, the member is not the owner. And this concept is actually carried through in a couple of memorandum opinions, I think, also out of the fourth court, and I can provide those to the court later on with regard to limited partnerships. But regardless of what the courts say with respect to limited partners in limited liability partnerships or limited partnerships, I don't think those facts are in play here.
Could AHF, I mean, could they get equitable title if they chose to of the subsidiary? And if so, isn't this just really form over substance?
I don't think Atlantic has equitable title. I don't think it can get equitable title unless it, you know, under those limited areas in which somebody is, you know, a purchaser in an earnest money contract or something like that, mm-hmm. or perhaps a beneficiary during the probate of a will proceeding or something like that. Our position is that Atlantic simply does not have equitable ownership, buttressed by the fact that Section 101.106 of the Business Organization Code prevents that.
Well, a property subject to a deed of trust, I mean, I don't want to get far afield here, but I mean, it seems to me that the record owner is in the trustee, but I would have equitable ownership, and you're saying that I wouldn't qualify under that event.
Well, that's actually addressed in the tax code specifically. Lien holders are not considered owners. That's a specific code section somewhere else in the tax code that says the owner is, basically says that lien holders are not owners for the purpose of how you list the property on the appraisal roll. So if, in this instance, Atlantic were a lien holder, it would absolutely not be an equitable owner for the purpose of this case.
How does it impair the purpose of the statute to consider an equitable owner like this, a member of an LLC, who has the absolute right to control the LLC? It's true that legal title is somewhere else, but you have the absolute control over it. How does that impair the statute?
I'm not sure that is the issue as much as what the plain language of the statute requires. But here's how I'm sorry.
But humor me and answer that part of it.
Okay.
You're probably right, but if we were looking at the purpose of it, does it impair it or defeat it in any way?
I think it could impair the statute. Here's how it could happen. you have situations where you have an owner that has absolute control, you have an owner that has some control. So you get into a situation of uncertainty, which requires yet another fact determination. The chief appraiser now has to go behind the, let's say, the member of the LLC and determine how much control the member of the LLC has over the LLC. What happens, for example, if you have two members who has control? What if this is a general partnership that owns a partnership that owns the property? Where do you go there? So, yes, I think it would impair the statute to allow an owner who claims to be the equitable owner to get that exemption. I want to also address some things that Arbor says in its brief on the merits about disregarded entities and why this is a statutory scheme that benefits everybody. It may be true that the Internal Revenue Service treats members of LLCs as disregarded entities in this particular tax framework, income tax framework, but that does not automatically mean that if it's a disregarded entity at the federal level, that the exemption should automatically be carried into state property tax at this level. Arbers would have this court grant the exemption by implication. And in another case we've cited, Bullock versus National Bank Shares, this court has held not only that exemptions are strictly construed and are the antithesis of equality and uniformity because it requires individuals and businesses to pay higher taxes, but it also says that in this context, it's a very strict standard. And bear with me for just a moment, please. In Bullock, this court said that an exemption cannot be raised by implication, but must affirmatively appear, and that all doubts are resolved in favor of the taxing authority. So Arbers would ask this court to overturn its own holding and say that now we can have exemptions by inference now, which would essentially toss the entire standard about how courts are supposed to look at exemptions out the window. So I think Arbor's position is tenuous at best. They're asking the court to infer that there's an exemption here. Because of the federal tax guidelines on disregarded entities, et cetera, our contention is that the business organization code prevents that. And even if the business organization code didn't have that provision, and even if the standard was not as strict as it is, our contention still is that the exemption fails because as the Cameron Village case and the Brazos County cases say, look at the plain language of the code section. Look at the plain language of the statute. And twice in the statute, in 11.182, it requires that the owner is entitled to the exemption, that the owner has to follow all these requirements in order to get the exemption. Frankly, we submit that the Amarillo Court of Appeals case that's cited in Arbor's brief is misdirected and probably wrong. That's the Southeast Texas housing case versus Harris County Appraisal District. You know, this court, the Supreme Court, has at least three times determined that ownership is in the fee simple owner. And those cases are in our brief. That's in the Childress case in Bailey versus Cherokee County Appraisal District. In that case, there is a pending probate. and the this court said that the heirs have no standing, even though they're perhaps equitable owners. And then there's the Texas Turnpike Authority case from the 1950s, where this court held that a contingent remainder is not equitable title for any reason. So the cases that this court has addressed when ownership comes up, and it's rare, you know, when it's an equitable versus fee simple ownership issue, but the cases in which it comes up, this court has held that you look at the plain meaning and that ownership means exactly that, ownership. It's not an esoteric equitable concept or anything like that. So in summary, I just want to say again that the 10th Court of Appeals only addressed the audit issue, and our position is that every single element of 11.182 needs to be followed. There is a public policy reason for the audit requirement that it be delivered to the chief appraiser and the TDHCA, and that is to prevent abuse, to prevent fraud.
Counsel, in the little time you have remaining, let me ask you a little bit about your idea of the term owner. If there's a 25% ownership relationship in a two-tier structure, are both entities owners, the 75% owner and the 25%?
In other words, if the fee simple owner has a split 75-25% ownership, then the fee simple owner would be the owner. In other words, if it's an LLC.
Both entities or just the 75% owner?
No, sir. Neither entity that owns a piece of the fee simple owner would be an owner. In other words, let's say this is a general partnership, and you have a 75% partner and a 25% partner. The owner of the property would not be the partners. The owner would be the partnership.
If they're partners that own the property, and they own it 75% and 25%, both are owners, in your view?
No. No, Your Honor. Neither partner is an owner, because the owner is the partnership.
Take a partnership out of it. Just talking about two individuals. And I'm trying to figure out how you determine that own means only legal title owner. Two individuals, one owns 75%, the other owns 25% of the property. Are both owners, as you read this term?
Yes, they would be co-tenants.
Okay. And you determine that from this word, how?
If you have two owners who are individuals, my understanding of property law is that they would be co-tenants or tenants in common. Partnership law says that if they are partners in a partnership, then it's the partnership that owns the property. And I think under the Business Organizations Code with regard to limited partnerships, it's the same deal. The limited partnership is the owner, not the LP.
There's nothing in statutory legislative history that provides any further information about that term?
Not in 11.182. I haven't found any. I mean, there might be some somewhere else. I don't know where it is. Thank you, Justices.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court. I'd like to start by addressing the Texas Supreme Court precedents that counsel raised a minute ago. The Bullitt case, the Texas Turnpike case, the Childers case. All of those cases are distinguishable. As a threshold matter, the Bullitt case is distinguishable on the point of being irrelevant, because all it does is lay out the black letter law as far as analyzing tax statutes, not an equitable ownership statute. That case involved national banking associations and a disparate treatment between taxing holding companies that were residing in Texas and were Texas citizens, or not taxing those entities, yet taxing Texas state banks. So that's a black letter law case. The Texas Turnpike case issued by this court, opinion issued by this court, is it recognizes the availability of equitable ownership. And this court, going all the way back to 1938 in the Realty Trust Craddock case, has always said that own is subject to disparate and various meanings. And when that is the case, like it is here, even under strict construction, step one, you look at the purpose and the intent of the statute. And the only purpose and intent of the statute here for 11.182 is to provide and further the availability of affordable housing for low and moderate income Texans. And in that, the only interpretation of the term own that provides for that is one that includes equitable ownership, because it allows for these marketplace realities such as financing on projects. Banks don't want to cross-collateralize multiple projects. Atlantic doesn't want to own 15 different low to moderate income apartment complexes because the complexity of getting a loan on one project, that project, if it defaults, would subject its other loans for the other projects to potential default as well. It's just not realistic, and that's why these specific purpose entities are set up to own the project themselves. You've got insurability, you've got bankruptcy remoteness, all these practical matters. And further, if the court was to assume, to accept the Walker County's interpretation, which is every time somebody wants to apply under 11.182 or the new statute, they have to be a CHDO or a charitable organization, that means they'll have to identify a project that's for sale, go and purchase that project after they have already become a registered CHDO or after they've gone and applied for a 501c3 determination. That's not a quick process. During that time, that project can be sold to somebody else. That project can go into bankruptcy. Many things can happen, and that's why the only interpretation that truly furthers the purposes of the Act allows for equitable ownership, because it allows for these specific purpose entities to go out and hold these properties, finance these properties, insure these properties.
The Court of Appeals only addressed the G issue, subsection G, and the parties have argued a lot here about the ownership issue, but the respondent has raised a number of other issues, and is it the case that if the respondent were right about some of those issues, that would defeat the exemption as well, or what's the status of all those issues?
When you're talking about the other issues, Your Honor, I want to make sure that
raised in the brief and response and then addressed in the reply brief.
Your Honor, this case was presented to the court. As threshold matters, the trial court struck all of Arbor's summary judgment evidence. Every single piece of it was a blanket order, struck every single sentence in the affidavit, all of the attachments. It was up to the Court of Appeals. The issue before the Court of Appeals was twofold, just like it is in front of this court. One, equitable ownership. Two, does Arbor's independently comply? In the oral argument in front of the Court of Appeals, the argument centered almost entirely on the equitable ownership issue in distinguishing our case from the Brazos County opinion. The opinion that we received from that court was a little bit of a surprise. Essentially found what they believed to be one area where we did not comply, and that was the basis for their holding. Now, to clarify something that counsel said earlier, there is no evidence in this case that the audit was not in fact delivered to the TDHCA. No evidence in this case it wasn't delivered. The evidence is an audit was created, audit was delivered to Walker County Appraisal District. Walker County Appraisal District is the party who determines whether or not we get the exemption. That's the current status of the G issue. And so, Your Honor, I think all of these issues are before the court today. I definitely believe that the equitable ownership issue is ripe. I think it's important. I think that property owners in the state would like to hear from the court on this issue. And I think if the court sides in favor of Walker County restricts the interpretation of the term owns, it not only negatively impacts applicants under 11.182, but under the new statute as well. And that risks the benefit of the statute basically being eviscerated at that point.
Thank you, Mr. Sheehan and Mr. Evans. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Ayes. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.